Take your Bibles and turn to Exodus. Going to be in chapter 4. We're going to look at verses 1 through 17. Kind of a focus on 11 and 12, but we're going to look at 1 through 17. Yeah, you really like set the tone here. And before we dig in, we're going to look back just a little bit. You don't have to turn there, but at chapter 3, we are coming in chapter 4, in halfway through a conversation between Moses and God. This is the story of the burning bush. And in chapter 3 is when we see God call out to Moses, call Moses to him. And we see the first half of this conversation where God tells Moses that he is going to be the instrument with which he's going to deliver the Israelites from Egypt. They've been in captivity for so many years, and Moses is going to be the one God uses to bring them out of captivity. And he tells them that, chapter 3, this is when we get the direction, and Moses is hesitant at best. We see Moses question and wonder how possibly this could be the case. We see him ask God, what if they don't believe me? What can I do? And so this is the beginning of the conversation, and then we get to chapter 4, and we see Moses still continue to question God and question whether this is really possible, if Moses can possibly be the one to lead them out of Egypt. Moses, at this point, had been in Midian for 40 years. He was a shepherd. He was just a shepherd, not a particularly high-class job. He was just a shepherd out was tending to his father-in-law's flock. How could he possibly lead the Israelites out of Egypt? And this is what we see in chapter 4. Read with me. In verse 1, Moses answered, "What if they won't believe me and will not obey me, but say, 'The Lord did not appear to you?' The Lord asked him, 'What is that in your hand?' 'A staff,' he replied. 'Throw it on the ground,' he said. So Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. The Lord told Moses, 'Stretch out your hand and grab it by the tail.' So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. 'This will take place,' he continued, 'so that they will believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you.' In addition, the Lord said to him, 'Put your hand inside your cloak.' So he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, his hand was diseased, resembling snow. 'Put your hand back inside your cloak,' he said. So he put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, it had become like the rest of his skin. 'If they will not believe you and will not respond to the evidence of the first sign, they may believe the evidence of the second sign. And if they don't believe even these two signs or listen to what you say, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the Nile will become blood on the ground.' But Moses replied to the Lord, 'Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, either in the past or recently or since you have been speaking to your servant, because my mouth and my tongue are sluggish.' The Lord said to him, 'Who placed a mouth on humans? Who makes a person mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go. I will help you speak, and I will teach you what to say.' Moses said, 'Please, Lord, send someone else.' Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, 'Isn't Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And also, he is on his way now to meet you. He will rejoice when he sees you. You will speak with him and tell him what to say. I will help both you and him to speak and will teach you both what to do. He will speak to the people for you. He will serve as a mouth for you, and you will serve as God to him. And take this staff in your hand that you will perform the signs with." So, verse 1, chapter 4. Like I said, this conversation had already been going on for a while. It's not the beginning of Moses protesting. In fact, verse 1 is the third protest Moses gives. "What if they won't believe me and will not obey me, but say, 'The Lord did not appear to you?'" Moses is asking God, he's like, what credit do I have as just this random man showing up in Egypt saying, "I've been sent by God to rescue you"? And so the Lord gives three three things as, first, they are proof to Moses. First one is the staff into the snake. God tells Moses, throw the staff on the ground, and it becomes a snake, and immediately Moses runs from it. Moses reacts in fear to God's power, and specifically to the snake, because snakes are very common in Egypt, in this area where Moses was from. Snakes were very dangerous. And then God tells him, grab the snake by the tail. I don't know if any of y'all have ever caught snakes before, but when you catch, if you catch a snake, you don't want to catch it by the tail, because that gives the snake all the freedom to move. This was the most vulnerable position for Moses to be in. Grabbing the snake, possibly venomous, by the tail is the most vulnerable place for Moses to be in, because it gives him the greatest chance of being bitten. God tells Moses to do this because it puts him in a position of being forced to trust. There was nothing Moses could do here to protect himself when God said, grab the snake by the tail. It's the snake was in control, so to speak, of what happened there. But Moses had to trust God and trust what God said so that the snake would turn back into staff. It's going to be a running theme here of Moses being forced to trust God. And this is the first example of it. God is using something intentionally very dangerous to Moses and something known to Moses to put him in a position where all he can do is trust. Moses doesn't have a choice here. The second thing that God uses to prove to Moses, it's tangible proof that God is giving Moses, is the diseased hand. Now in verse 6, when it says, put your hand inside your cloak, a more accurate translation of that verse is to say, put your hand to your chest. Now the reason this is significant is because having your hand be diseased and putting it close to your chest is all the more dangerous. And when it says put your hand back inside your cloak, he's putting his diseased hand back to his bare chest, back to his bare skin. Once again, something that Moses would never willingly do. He would never willingly hold the disease so close to him like that. Diseases were greatly feared because they didn't have medicine, they didn't have any of the practices we have now to help with diseases, so diseases were terrifying in their own right. So far that anyone that was diseased, especially skin diseases like this, we hear a lot about leprosy in the Bible, someone that was diseased like this would be ostracized from the community, would be kicked out, and for to go anywhere near people would need to identify themselves as diseased, because that was how great the fear was regarding diseases such as this. Once again, that is what God is using to show his power to Moses. God is using these things that are directly terrifying to Moses. And God, of course, knew that, and why he chose this. Sickness was also seen as a sign of judgment by most people. Because sickness came about to them to unknown causes, it was seen as a sign of judgment. And then that the only way to be cured from a sickness, a disease like this, was by God's power. When Moses would have given this message, these words to the Israelites, if they were reading this or listening to this, whichever one, they would have been appalled that Moses, the great hero Moses, was diseased like this because of that, of the stigma regarding diseases. Considering that it was judgment, the fact that Moses, their hero, for lack of a better word, would be diseased, it would be appalling. So first, those two things are tangible proof to Moses, something he can see and feel and experience. In chapter 3, God tells Moses pretty well exactly how events are going to play out. God tells Moses, you're going to go, you're going to talk to the Israelites, you're going to tell them Yahweh has sent you, then you're going to talk to the Egyptians, and through God's power, Moses would free the Israelites. But that theoretical explanation from God wasn't enough for Moses, which is why he protests again in verse for. So God gives him tangible proof. The second thing these miracles are is they are proof to the Israelites. The important part of the staff into the snake and the diseased hand are that those are both easily repeatable miracles. Now, I mean, I couldn't go and take any staff and turn into a snake, but for Moses and for God, those are easily repeatable miracles. He's always going to have his staff with him, and he's always going to have his cloak, and so he can always perform those two miracles. Moses was going to have to go around Egypt and essentially convince the Israelites to follow him. It wasn't going to be just a go do the miracles, and now the entire nation of Israel was following Moses. He would have to go, and he would have to convince groups of Israelites individually, and that's what these miracles allowed him to do. He would always have the staff, and he could throw the staff on the ground, turn it into a snake for any group. Same with the diseased hand. It was a repeatable, tangible proof to the Israelites. They also, like for Moses, served as extra assurance for the Israelites, because God had given Moses the name Yahweh. He told him, when they ask who sent you, tell them that Yahweh has sent you. I am who I am has sent you. If that were not enough, these miracles from Moses are proof, visible proof to the Israelites. People often, I think we often don't like to deal with hypotheticals. We want something real, something we can hold and feel and see before we believe. You know, they say seeing is believing. That's not really necessarily true, but that's the saying, isn't it? Seeing is believing. And so that's what these miracles serve as to Moses and to the Israelites. And then third, they are the beginning of proof to the Egyptians. See, these three miracles would each have pretty great significance to the Egyptians. First, the snakes. Snakes, like I said, were very common in Egypt, something Egyptians would have been very intimately familiar with. They were also commonly associated with wisdom, Egyptian gods, and royalty. Think of pictures or statues you see of pharaohs and their headdresses and a little snake on top. Snakes were associated with wisdom and gods and the royalty. They were a significant symbol to the Egyptians. God using the snakes is a way of showing his power greater than that of the Egyptians. Same with the diseases. The Egyptians also believed that diseases were judgment from the gods. And in order to be cured by diseases, you must petition the gods to cure your disease. And if they couldn't, then there must be some deserved reason for it. It was punishment, the Egyptians believed. And so God and Moses, to show this power of the disease coming and then being healed, is once again God exercising his power over things that the Egyptians were familiar with. And then the third miracle, talks about in verse 9, is not one that we see here. He doesn't perform this miracle for Moses, but he tells Moses, if the Israelites don't believe once again after the first two miracles, then take some water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, and it will turn to blood. The Nile was perhaps the most important thing for the Egyptians. The Nile was the source of all life. It ran right through Egypt, and it was where all the water and life and sustenance came from. Egypt is in a very barren part of the world, in the middle of deserts, but thanks to the Nile, the river running through Egypt, they were able to live and be sustained by this river. So this was something that was hugely, hugely important to them. And they had gods associated with the Nile. They had multiple gods of the Nile, gods of the filling of the Nile. So the Nile River itself was important to them both literally and religiously. And all three of these things, God exercises his power over directly. He's proving his power over everything that the Egyptians hold most important. This is the beginning of proof to the Egyptians. Of course, we know that he would go on and would later have the rest of the plagues. There you go. the rest of the plagues that God would send to the Egyptians to further prove his power. But this is the beginning. All three of these miracles are each repeatable in their own way and are used as proof to the people that Moses would have to go talk to. And we look at that and we would think, you might think, surely that would be enough. Surely that since God has given him these signs, these wonders, something that is so outside the realm of human possibility, that Moses would think, okay, I understand now, God, you got this, we got this, let's go free the Israelites from Egypt. We can do this. But that's not what happens. See, in verse 10, we see Moses protest once again. Replied, Lord, please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, either in the past or recently, or since you have been speaking to your servant, because my mouth and my tongue are sluggish. Now, the exact nature of what Moses is saying here is up for debate. It could be that he had a stutter of some kind or some like speech impediment that caused him to not be able to talk well. And so he said, God, with this ailment, with this handicap, surely there's no way that I can free the Israelites. Or maybe he's saying that he can't speak Egyptian very well because he had been in Midian, away from Egypt for 40 years, so maybe his Egyptian was a little rusty. And so he said, God, I can't remember enough words, so I will not be able to free the Israelites. That's another possibility. Or maybe he was saying, maybe it was sort of like stage fright, sort of, oh, the pressure will get to me, I can't save the Israelites. Or maybe it was just a general protest. This was another reason saying that Moses was saying, I can't save the Israelites. And that's where Moses gets it wrong. See, Moses may have had the speech impediment, or maybe he couldn't have spoken Egyptian very well, or maybe he didn't think that he was smart enough, or he could think quickly enough to convince the Israelites and the Pharaoh and the Egyptians, because Moses was all focused on himself. Every time Moses protests, what if I can't convince them? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh in verse 11 of chapter 3? What if they won't believe me and will not obey me? Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent. Moses is entirely focused on what he can and can't do. And God replies, who placed a mouth on humans? Who makes a person mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Essentially, who created you? Who has the power to create you? Who created you with all of the things that you're saying prevent you from saving the Israelites? God tells Moses that it is not by Moses' power that this is going to happen. Moses is so focused on his own capabilities that he's completely forgot about what God can do. Who created you, God says, with everything that you think prevents you? There's an interesting thing here. In Hebrew, the word for I that's used by Moses in verse 10 is anoki, just a word for I. When God says, is it not I, the Lord, and I will help you speak, I will teach you what to say, God uses the same word for I, anoki. And it's a bit of a parallel structure we see here, where Moses is saying, my I, my anoki, is not good enough. And God says, but mine is, my I am sufficient, even if you are not. I created you, I have the power to create you, I am the one that makes a person mute or deaf, seeing or blind. So we see the Lord, that is his rebuttal against Moses' protest. And then verse 12, after we see in verse 11, this reassurance, verse 12, we see the command. Verse 12 begins very simply, now go. See, verse 11, Moses tells him, I created you. I have the power. This is my power, not yours. Now go. God commands Moses. It is not a question that God is asking Moses here. And see, if you look back, God actually never asked Moses a question. It's not a rhetorical one. Every time they talk, God is saying, this is what will happen. This is what you will do. This is the miracles that you're going to perform. You are going to deliver the Israelites. I am going to deliver the Israelites through you. God never asks Moses a question, and yet Moses keeps answering them with his own protest, with his own reasons that it can't happen. But God doesn't ask a question. God says, now go. In my Bible, it has an exclamation point, not even a period, an exclamation point. Okay, this isn't just go, I guess. This is now go, Moses. This is a command. This is an imperative that God is giving Moses. He goes on and says, I will help you speak, and I will teach you what to say. Moses is God is reassuring Moses, yes, I will be with you. Yes, I will give you my power to accomplish this. Now go. He gives the reassurance first, gives the comfort of saying, I will teach you what to say, and then the command of saying, now go. Not a question, but a command. And now surely, that would be enough. He's got the proof. He's got the reassurance from God saying, I'm going to help you. Surely that would be enough for Moses, right? Unfortunately, no. Verse 13, we see Moses once again protest. Moses says, please, Lord, send someone else. Now, there's a key difference here between protest in verse 13 and all the other protests that Moses gives to God. All the others Moses gives are questions. They're concerns. What if they don't believe me? What if I can't speak well? What if they're not going to believe that it's God, the real God who sent me? They're all concerns that Moses is bringing before God, and God can answer directly. It doesn't matter that you can't speak. I'll speak through you. It doesn't matter if they won't believe that I sent you. Here are the proofs. Here are the miracles to show them. But this one is different. This is not a concern Moses brings before God and says, what's your solution to this? This is Moses saying, I don't want to. He says, Lord, please send someone else. This is directly asking to not fulfill the calling that God has for him here. Directly saying, send someone else. I don't want to go. While God's many rebuttals, many reasons should have been enough, Moses is still insistent on not following God's calling. This, one could argue that the other protests are simply concerns of Moses. It's not that he doesn't want to do it. It's just that he's worried. He doesn't know how it's going to play out. He doesn't know what he can do. But then this one, verse 13, is very clearly disobedience. Moses says, please, Lord, send someone else. After all the calls, after every command, every time God has said, you are going to go to Egypt, you are going to be my instrument to free the Israelites, Moses once again says, send someone else. And we see the Lord's anger burn against Moses. For all my parents in here, it's like when you have a child and you repeatedly tell them to go clean your room or go whatever direction you give them. I've never been on the receiving end of that, I swear. See, I can make jokes at the pastor's kid expense, too. It goes both ways. It's like that, when you repeatedly tell them, and every time they're like, oh, but my legs are tired, oh, but this, and I can't do it because, and I don't want to because, and this and that, and God says, go. But he argues every single time, like a child arguing with his parents. And I imagine that is very similar to the Lord, what the Lord is feeling here. Moses acting like a stubborn child, and God giving him his command. So the Lord's anger burned against Moses and says, "Isn't Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. He is on his way now to meet you." Here we see something really cool about the nature of God, really complex about the nature of God. First, we see the Lord's reaction to Moses. The Lord is angry with Moses, genuinely angry. The Lord's anger burned. I do not feel that that is a word that is used lightly. The Lord's anger burned against Moses. Of course, because the Lord is tired of Moses' many arguments. Again, parents, I'm sure y'all know that feeling. But he also says, he reminds Moses of Aaron, his brother. Now, clearly, this is someone that when God says this, Moses knew. So they had met at some point, Moses and Aaron. They knew each other. Moses was familiar with Aaron. And God says, "Isn't he on his way?" Now, this isn't just pure happenstance. I don't believe God often deals in happenstance. God, in his divine all-knowingness, knew exactly how Moses would respond to every single thing. Every time Moses said, "I can't," God knew years and years and years since the beginning of time, God knew Moses was going to say that, because God is all-knowing. So, what we see here is, through Aaron, God provides a backup plan. Not really a backup plan, because God always knew, so it was always the plan, but from our perspective and from Moses' perspective, it's a backup plan that God has provided. God knew Moses would protest, so he provides Aaron as the solution. We see the dichotomy of God here, where God can both be angry at Moses for what he says, for what he's doing, for his disobedience, and he can also know about that way ahead of time and provide a solution. It can be both. And then we see almost a direct parallel for 11 and 12, but now Aaron is thrown into the mix. "You will speak with him and tell him what to say. I will help both of you and him to speak, and I will teach you both what to do." See, while the circumstances have changed a little bit, now instead of just Moses, now it's Moses and Aaron. And now they're going to be the instrument. The circumstances have changed, but God hasn't. God hasn't changed. God is still saying, "I'm still going to teach you both now. I'm still going to help you both now. Both of your words are going to be my words. I'm still going to be there with both of you. Despite your protest, and despite how you would change the situation, God does not change." So he provides Aaron as the solution to this problem. And now Aaron will go with Moses. We do see a bit of a difference here. In verse 16, it describes the relationship of Moses and Aaron. "You will tell him what to say, and you will serve as God to him." Now, that is not say that Moses is God now. What it is saying is that they will perform similar roles as God and Moses do. See, God up here is giving the words to Moses. "This is what you're going to say, Moses. This is what you're going to do. You're going to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. This is how this is going to work." Similarly, now Moses is doing the same for Aaron. Aaron is now the mouth, the spokesperson for Moses. So in that sense, Moses is serving as God for Aaron, because God has provided Aaron for Moses' solution, or for Moses' protest. That is the solution. And it is not all good for Moses, because he loses something here. Now Moses, due to his protests and to his arguments, he no longer gets to be the sole instrument of God working. He no longer gets to be the person that leads the Israelites out of Egypt. Now Aaron is sharing that glory. Of course, we know that in the end, it is all really God's glory anyway. But now Moses is sharing the spotlight, so to speak, with Aaron. Moses doesn't no longer gets to be the person, the guy, the hero of the Israelites. Then it ends in verse 17 and says, take this staff in your hand that you'll perform the signs with. It seems like kind of a weird cutoff to this conversation because it just stops there. Verse 18, then Moses went back to his father-in-law. So 17 is the end of what we have of this conversation. And it seems like a kind of weird ending. But if you take a second to think about what it really means, it is just another way. It's this parallel, once again, of 11 and 12. Verse 12, the end of that section, says, now go. That's effectively what 17 is. Take this staff in your hand. Take the instrument that you're going to use to perform these miracles with in your hand, and now go like I told you to. Take the staff and go that you will perform the signs with. Once again, not a question God's asking Moses. There's no debate here. Take the staff that you will perform the signs with. Go like I told you to. I will be with you. Now go. Church, if you haven't figured it out yet, we all too often are Moses in this scenario. We are the ones that argue with God, and we say, but God, I'm scared. I can't speak. I can't do this. I don't know what to say. What if I can't do it? What if I can't save them? All the focus is on me. What can I do? What does my power hold? All too often, we are like Moses, arguing like a stubborn child with our Heavenly Father. And you know what God says? Whenever we bring him our protests, or we say we can't do this, that, and the other, God says, I know. He says, I know. I created you that way. I've known this since the beginning. There was never a doubt in my mind, God says, of your abilities. He says, I know, I created you that way. Now go anyway. There's no thing that we can bring to God and he's gonna be like, oh crap, I forgot about that. There's no protest we can bring to God that's gonna surprise him and it's gonna derail his plans. I think it is a bit almost egotistical to think that we could derail God's plans. How high and mighty are we to say that if our shortcomings are so great that we derail God's plans? We bring those to him, he says, I know, and he says, go. I promise you, for each and every one of you, God is calling you to something. I don't know what that is, necessarily, but I know he is. There's not a Christian for which God doesn't have a calling for. He doesn't ask us to be the perfect instrument for that calling. There is not a verse in here where it says we have to be good enough. But there are hundreds of verses that say that God is good enough. We don't have to be the perfect instrument of God's plan. He just tells us to go. Trust him and go. Like I said, I don't know what his calling is for you, but I know that it's there. I know that there is a calling on your life. For every Christian, there is a calling. It may be to something like serving full-time in ministry. It may be to be serving more voluntarily in your church. It may be more committing to coming to church more. It may be any of those things. But there's a calling. If you're not a Christian, there is still a calling. And that one's a lot easier to describe. For the non-Christian, for the non-believer, the calling is simple. God is calling you to him. And that also doesn't depend on us being good enough either. He says, God says, you got to stop. God says, you're not good enough. I know you're not good enough. You can tell me over and over again how not good enough you are. And every single time he will say, I know, I didn't ask that. I called you to me. I called you to my mission. I called you to go. Church, he's calling you to go. Regardless of the circumstances, regardless of what you can do, God is calling you to go. He is calling everyone to him and to go and fulfill his mission. That's what this passage shows us. We, like Moses, argue some more, and then we argue again. And God says, that doesn't matter. None of that matters. Now go, he says. I will help you speak, and I will teach you what to say. Church, we need to answer that calling. We need to answer God saying, yes, I will go. Now go, he says, and I will be with you. Pray with me. Lord, thank you, first and foremost. Thank you that you are so amazing and so powerful of a God, that you are there right beside us the entire time. Lord, thank you that we don't have to be good enough. Because if we did, not much would ever really get done. We can't accomplish much on our own. Thank you for being God that is with us. And Lord, I ask that for all of us in this church, and for Christians everywhere, but firstly for all of us here today, that we will answer that calling that you have for us. That we will say yes when you will say go, and that through us, by your great power, you will do truly amazing things. We love you, and we praise you. Amen.